Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. In this episode, we look at new research on mucoactive therapy for bronchiectasis, aspirin use in anticoagulated patients with coronary disease, and sotatercept for early pulmonary arterial hypertension. We explore the genetics behind misdiagnosed common diseases and review uncertainty in medical training. We also share a case of systemic amyloidosis and perspectives on sickle cell disease, fetal personhood, and living with a genetic diagnosis. Hypertonic saline or carbocysteine in bronchiectasis by Judy Bradley from Queen's University, Belfast, United Kingdom, and co-authors. Bronchiectasis is characterized by chronic cough, sputum production, chest pain, and shortness of breath. These symptoms, together with recurrent pulmonary exacerbations, reduce patients' quality of life and their survival. Bronchiectasis guidelines are inconsistent with regard to the effectiveness of mucoactive agents, and their use varies geographically. Large trials are needed to assess safety and effectiveness of these agents. This 52-week trial in the United Kingdom assessed the effectiveness of 6% hypertonic saline or carbocysteine as compared with standard care in 288 participants with non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis. In these participants with bronchiectasis, neither hypertonic saline nor carbocysteine significantly reduced the mean incidence of pulmonary exacerbations over a period of 52 weeks. John Hansen Flaschen and Gregory Tino from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, ask in an editorial, how should clinicians respond to this groundbreaking trial by Bradley and co-authors? The results have shown convincingly that neither hypertonic saline nor carbocysteine should be prescribed routinely for continuous daily use across the broad spectrum of patients who have symptomatic bronchiectasis. However, these editorialists caution against abandoning airway mucoactive therapy altogether on the basis of this one trial. The meticulously constructed and executed trial by Bradley et al. Underscores unavoidable pragmatic limitations in clinical trial design assessing airway clearance techniques. A promising next step may be to assess whether these therapies effectively reopen distal airways narrowed or occluded by secretions. Until further evidence is available, the editorialists recommend continuing to use airway clearance selectively for patients with bronchiectasis and chronic or acute chest congestion who are motivated to actively engage in their therapy. The choice of clearance method and use of an adjunctive mucoactive agent should be individualized on the basis of clinician assessment and patient-reported experience with airway clearance. Aspirin in patients with chronic coronary syndrome receiving oral anticoagulation by J. Lemel from Centre Hospitalier Universitaire, Lille, France, and co-authors. The appropriate antithrombotic regimen for patients with chronic coronary syndrome who are at high atherothrombotic risk and receiving long-term oral anticoagulation remains unknown. This trial in France investigated the efficacy and safety of adding aspirin, 100 milligrams once daily, to long-term oral anticoagulation therapy, as compared with oral anticoagulation therapy alone, in 872 patients with chronic coronary syndrome who had undergone stent implantation more than 6 months before enrollment and were at high risk for atherothrombotic events. Patients were randomly assigned to receive aspirin or placebo. All the patients continued to receive their current oral anticoagulation therapy. The addition of aspirin increased the risk of a composite of cardiovascular death, myocardial infarction, stroke, systemic embolism, coronary revascularization, or acute limb ischemia, as well as an increased risk of death from any cause and major bleeding. Common diseases in clinical cohorts, not always what they seem. By Fadiq Rahimov from the Genomics Research Center, ABVI, North Chicago, Illinois, and co-authors. Accurate and timely diagnosis is crucial in healthcare because it identifies a patient's health issue and guides treatment decisions. However, misdiagnoses have always affected the delivery of quality healthcare and continue to harm an unacceptable number of patients. It is estimated that 5% of U.S. adults who seek medical care each year receive an erroneous diagnosis, sometimes with severe consequences. The adoption of high-throughput DNA sequencing technology has dramatically increased the rate and speed of making a correct diagnosis, primarily in patients with cancer or rare or undiagnosed diseases, leading to notable improvements in clinical care. The authors of this study investigated the presence of monogenic disease-causing variants within cohorts of patients with diagnoses of common diseases. 4 common and complex diseases were selected: multiple sclerosis, 2 inflammatory bowel diseases, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and atopic dermatitis. Using UK Biobank sequencing data, the investigators found variants that cause a broad range of rare Mendelian diseases in persons with diagnoses of these common diseases. The study shows that rare genetic diseases can be misdiagnosed as common diseases, which may have implications for clinical trials as well as for diagnosis and treatment. In an editorial, Peter Robinson from the Berlin Institute of Health at Charité Universitätsmedizin Berlin writes that precision medicine tailors clinical management strategies for treatment and prevention in light of each person's genetic makeup, history of environmental exposures, and lifestyle. Although diagnostic genomic sequencing has enabled meaningful changes in the clinical care of persons with cancer and rare genetic disease, its influence on common complex disease has been limited. Now, Rahimov and co-authors present an alternative approach to precision genomics in persons with a diagnosis of a common disease on the premise that a rare genetic disease with overlapping symptoms may be misdiagnosed as a common disease. The main finding of the current study is that misdiagnoses of rare diseases as common ones are not infrequent. If the results of the current study are generalizable, then a modest but appreciable proportion of persons with atopic dermatitis, multiple sclerosis, or inflammatory bowel disease stand to benefit from genetic testing to identify the causes of rare diseases and tailor clinical management. Sotatercept for pulmonary arterial hypertension within the first year after diagnosis, by Valerie McLaughlin from the University of Michigan Medical School, Ann Arbor, and co-authors. Sotatercept, an activin signaling inhibitor, reduces morbidity and mortality among patients with long-standing pulmonary arterial hypertension. However, its effects in patients within the first year of a diagnosis of pulmonary arterial hypertension have been unclear. In this Phase 3 trial, 320 adult patients with pulmonary arterial hypertension who had received the diagnosis less than 1 year earlier had an intermediate or high risk of death and were receiving double or triple background therapy, were randomly assigned to receive add-on therapy with subcutaneous sotatercept or placebo every 21 days. The trial was stopped early owing to loss of clinical equipoise after the reporting of positive results from previous sotatercept trials. The addition of sotatercept to standard background therapy within the first year after the diagnosis of pulmonary arterial hypertension resulted in a lower risk of clinical worsening events than placebo among patients at an intermediate or high risk of death, with a hazard ratio of 0.24. Association of 2024-2025 COVID-19 Vaccine with COVID-19 Outcomes in U.S. Veterans by Miao Tsai from the Veterans Affairs St. Louis Healthcare System, Missouri, and co-authors. Amid the declining clinical severity of SARS-CoV-2 infection and diminishing public uptake of annual COVID-19 vaccines, contemporary evidence on vaccine effectiveness against clinically relevant outcomes is needed. This observational study used the electronic health records of the Department of Veterans Affairs to evaluate the effectiveness of the 2024-2025 COVID-19 vaccine among veterans who received the COVID-19 and influenza vaccines on the same day, and in an active comparator group of veterans who received the influenza vaccine only, between September 3 and December 31, 2024. This large cohort of participants were followed for 180 days or until the occurrence of an outcome, whichever came first. At 6 months of follow-up, the estimated vaccine effectiveness was 29.3% against COVID-19-associated emergency department visits, 39.2% against COVID-19-associated hospitalizations, and 64% against COVID-19-associated deaths. Educational strategies to prepare trainees for clinical uncertainty. A review article by Jonathan Ilgen from the University of Washington, Seattle, and Gurpreet Dhaliwal from the University of California, San Francisco. Uncertainty is ubiquitous in medical practice. If there was no uncertainty, society would not need physicians to render judgments. Managing clinical uncertainty is a foundational skill for a physician and is central to effective clinical reasoning. Teachers can reframe uncertainty as a central feature of how clinical problems are understood and managed. Clinicians can recognize uncertainty through a range of cues and navigate these experiences by using cyclic processes of forward planning and monitoring. Effective teaching conveys that uncertainty is not to be avoided, but rather is a reality of practice that can be identified and managed. Teachers can equip trainees to manage uncertainty by encouraging discussions about potential sources of uncertainty, diagnosis, treatment, or prognosis, and types of uncertainty, epistemic, for which additional information might reframe or reduce uncertainty, or aleatoric, for which outcomes are inherently variable. This characterization can help trainees understand, manage, and communicate uncertainty. Uncertainty can be reframed as a signal that there are opportunities for learning. Learning how to manage uncertainty is essential for clinicians in training. An 82-year-old woman with abdominal distension, edema, and pleural effusion. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Zahir Kanji and colleagues. An 82-year-old woman presented to the emergency department with progressive abdominal distension, lower extremity edema, and shortness of breath after returning from South America. Examination revealed pitting edema extending to the thighs, ascites, diminished breath sounds, and a holosystolic murmur. Laboratory studies showed marked hypoalbuminemia and proteinuria, and imaging demonstrated small pleural effusions and mild ascites. Despite initial treatment for presumed heart failure, persistent anasarca and nephrotic range proteinuria prompted further evaluation. Serum studies revealed a monoclonal IgA lambda component and elevated free light chains. Kidney biopsy showed Congo red positive deposits with lambda light chain restriction and randomly arranged amyloid fibrils, diagnostic of AL light chain amyloidosis. A bone marrow biopsy confirmed a plasma cell neoplasm with lambda light chain restriction, establishing systemic AL amyloidosis as the cause of her nephrotic syndrome and volume overload. Involving palliative care to improve outcomes in sickle cell disease. A perspective by Eberechi Nwogu-Oyemkepa from Washington University, St. Louis, and co-authors. Abiku in Yoruba means born to die. Ogbanji in Igbo refers to a child who dies young and is reborn again. Chwe 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 in Ga is the relentless repetitive sound of chewing or gnawing pain. For generations, the indigenous peoples of Africa have depicted sickle cell disease, SCD, using language evoking the agony that remains a hallmark of this debilitating condition. SCD can cause excruciating pain, life-threatening complications, multi-organ dysfunction, and premature death. Despite advances in therapy, mortality among people with SCD remains strikingly high. In 2021, an estimated 376,000 deaths from any cause were reported in this population worldwide. Additional efforts are needed to improve quality of life and mitigate suffering in these patients and their families. The field of palliative care is well positioned to help address this need. Palliative care encompasses interdisciplinary supportive care to improve quality of life in patients with serious illness and their caregivers, and can challenge the use of stereotyping or dehumanizing labels and advocate for cultural change to subvert implicit bias at the bedside. Palliative care teams are trained to recognize and address mistrust within historical contexts, to practice and model trauma-informed care, and to strengthen therapeutic alliance. Beyond centers of excellence, however, integration of palliative care into SCD management remains insufficient and inconsistent. People with SCD deserve access to compassionate, person-centered, goal-concordant care throughout their lives. 30 years of hydroxyurea for sickle cell anemia, scientific progress, global health gaps. A perspective by Enrico Costa from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Sickle cell anemia, SCA, was the first identified molecular disease. For decades, no treatment other than supportive care was available. In 1995, the journal published results from the multicenter study of hydroxyurea in sickle cell anemia, which was the first study to provide evidence that hydroxyurea is a disease-modifying drug, revealing that it reduces rates of vaso-occlusive crises. Hydroxyurea has since become part of standard treatment for SCA, reducing hospitalizations and the need for blood transfusions, and decreasing organ damage. Additional follow-up from the study showed that after 9 years, hydroxyurea was associated with reduced mortality. Yet, SCA is a global challenge, and in sub-Saharan Africa, it's estimated that only 1 to 13% of people with SCA receive hydroxyurea regularly. Another trial, the REACH trial, showed that hydroxyurea is safe and highly beneficial among patients in this region. Although bone marrow transplantation and gene therapy each require only a single procedure, they are about 10 to 100 times as expensive as lifetime use of hydroxyurea. Yet, the large majority of people with SCA in Africa aren't receiving hydroxyurea. Correcting this inequity should be a global health priority. Fetal personhood and reproductive criminalization. Implications for Patients, Clinicians, and Public Health. A perspective by Taylor Riley from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Asha Hassan from the University of Minnesota Medical School, Minneapolis. Fetal personhood ideology is the underlying force behind abortion bans and restrictions, the prosecution of pregnant women because of conduct deemed potentially harmful to the fetus, and fetal homicide laws that allow a fetus to be treated as the victim of a crime. The evolution of fetal personhood ideology has produced a legal, clinical, and social environment that exacerbates inequities and broadly endangers health and freedom. Today, criminalization is the primary tool used to enforce the concept of fetal personhood in the United States. Although much-needed attention has been paid to abortion access since the Dobbs decision, the ultimate goal of many members of the anti-abortion movement is to establish personhood rights from the moment of conception. The legal doctrine of fetal personhood recognizes embryos and fetuses as legal persons with constitutional rights. This approach implicates all aspects of reproductive health care, and in some cases, non-reproductive health care, from contraception to infertility treatment to any care that could be construed as endangering an embryo or fetus. It is imperative for healthcare professionals and public health practitioners to recognize the far-reaching implications that fetal personhood ideology has for reproductive, maternal, and infant healthcare and outcomes. Living in the Present Tense, a perspective by James Feinstein from the University of Colorado School of Medicine, Aurora. One day in February 2024, Dr. Feinstein's phone rang as he hurried across campus to see patients in his epidermolysis bullosa, EB, clinic. He let the call from an unfamiliar number go to voicemail, and a transcription appeared on his screen. "You have an abnormal test." Odd. He was not expecting test results. Dr. Feinstein directs a multidisciplinary clinic for children with EB, a very rare genetic disease. The condition causes extreme fragility of the skin and leads to lifelong blistering and wounding inside the body and out. People with EB live like patients with burn injuries, but without hope of escaping the fire. That day, Dr. Feinstein disclosed to new parents that their infant had junctional epidermolysis bullosa. The parents silently nodded as they talked about what this meant. They could expect a few wonderful weeks, then her nutrition would slip. Her life expectancy was less than a year. They might consider meeting with the palliative care team. Afterwards, Dr. Feinstein discovered he'd missed two more calls from the same number. Now concerned, he dialed back. "I'm a genetic counselor," the woman said. "You have an abnormal test that was run on a research biobank specimen. It's a rare but serious pathologic finding that may affect your health." Suddenly dizzy, Dr. Feinstein blurted, "What do I have?" But by law, she could not release the results without a confirmatory test. A month later, he saw the family back in his clinic. The dad said, "It was hard to hear, but we needed to remain in that sweet space for as long as we could. Now we're here. We are ready to meet the palliative care team." The parents didn't know it, but they were helping Dr. Feinstein navigate his own path, reminding him to savor the moment. A few days later, his test result appeared, SDHC. This individual is at increased risk for SDHC-associated hereditary paraganglioma and pheochromocytoma. Facing lifelong surveillance, he realized he could continue on with his anxious existence, or he could live each day of his life right now, no matter what came next. In our images in clinical medicine, a 34-year-old man with recent travel to Zimbabwe presented with a 4-day history of fever and generalized weakness. A painful, crusted ulceration was noted on the parietal scalp. a diagnosis of human East African trypanosomiasis, also known as sleeping sickness, was made. Another image shows thoracic ectopia cordis. A baby boy was transferred to a tertiary care hospital 5 days after birth. He had an intact manubrium, but no corpus of the sternum, which had resulted in complete displacement of the heart outside the chest wall, shown in a video at NEJM.org. Read more from our issue at NEJM.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@NEJM.org. Thank you for listening.